I know that none of you are going to be doing much traveling interstate anytime soon, but I thought I'd give you a few tips on how to stay out of trouble on your next road trip or cross-country adventure. So, if you are heading up to Oregon, be careful if you are driving with any urine containers in your car, because you may not know this, but it is illegal to throw containers of urine out of a vehicle. If you happen to be going to Delaware for some reason, be careful with any of the dog or cat hair or fur that you've been collecting. It is a second degree misdemeanor to recklessly sell or trade any hair or fur from either of these pets. If Michigan is on your itinerary, know that blasphemy is still against the law, so blaspheme the Lord at your own risk. While we're thinking about language, sorry to all of you salty sailors out there, but it's against the law if you're over 16 to swear at players or officials during a sporting event in Massachusetts. However, you can swear during a bingo game in North Carolina, which you might be tempted to do if you get fined for playing a single game of bingo that lasts longer than 5 hours, which is against the law. Got a few more that I want to run through real quickly here with you. You cannot bite off someone's arm in Rhode Island. It's against the law to commit adultery in New York. A teacher cannot talk to her students about handholding if you're in Tennessee. In Washington, you can't use an X-ray machine in order to help you size your shoe. You cannot sniff glue in Indiana with, quote, intent to cause a condition of intoxication, euphoria, excitement, exhilaration, stupefaction, or dulling of senses, end quote. In Georgia, you can't live on a boat for more than 30 days. In Southington, Connecticut, it is against the law to sell or use silly string. Yep, you got that one. And also in Connecticut, you cannot sell pickles or salsa at a farmer's market. These are crazy, right? This is insane. Like maybe we've gone a bit overboard with our lawmaking. Except this isn't new. For as long as there have been people making laws, there have been weird and crazy and obscure and sometimes dangerous laws on the books. There are laws that we really like, laws that benefit us, and there are laws that we don't like, laws that are hard to follow, laws that we don't really understand, laws that feel overly restrictive. Your life and mine exist under this elaborate system of laws. We live under a national constitution, and then under that, there are federal laws and statutes, and then we live in a state with a state constitution and its own laws, and within that, we live in a county, and we live in a city, and then there are dozens of other like regulatory organizations, agencies, and then we live in a house, and many of us have house rules or laws. And almost every aspect of our lives is governed by or even directed by these laws, these rules, these commands. This morning, we're going to take a look at the laws in the book of Esther. And let me say this right now, this won't be as boring as it sounds, I assure you. The laws in Esther are just about as crazy as some of the laws that I just ran through a second ago. And so stay with me. Now, this is gonna be a bit of a shift for us because over the last 4 weeks, we've looked at these like really interesting characters that make Esther such a gripping story. We've considered characters like King Xerxes and Mordecai and Haman and Esther herself. But one of the features of this book that ties these four characters together is that laws rule over their lives, that laws almost have a power unto themselves. Even the king, the guy who makes the laws, is often powerless against them. And so today, we are going to consider with Esther whether this book has anything for us about how to navigate laws in the world. How do we navigate a world with laws that are often outside of our control? You know, what is our relationship to the laws of society? What is our relationship to the laws of God? So let's just jump in and take a look at how strange some of these laws are. Open your Bibles with me to Esther chapter 1. I'm going to take you on a quick tour of Persia's laws, and as we move from verse to verse, I'm going to show you something kind of hiding behind our English translations. Not hiding in the Bible, but just behind the English translations we use. So I'm reading from the ESV, and you'll notice that sometimes you'll see the word law, and sometimes edict, and sometimes decree. These English words are different translations of the same Hebrew word that refers to a royal law of some kind. I will use the word law as I'm reading so that you can hear the word that connects these passages together, all right? So follow with me, starting in chapter 1, verse 8. We read, "And drinking was according to this law, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired." In Persia, there was a law mandating that you drink as much as you desire. In verse 19, we read, "If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws that Vashti is never again to come before King Xerxes." In Persia, the king creates an empire-wide law declaring that a single person was never to come into his presence again. Okay, chapter 2, verse 8, we read, "So when the king's order and his law were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, Esther also was taken." In Persia, the king creates a law commanding that young ladies be gathered into his possession for his pleasure. Then a few verses later, verse 12, we learn that there is a law about how each of these young ladies are to be prepared for him. We read, "Now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Xerxes after being 12 months under the laws for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with spices and ointments for women." Persia has a law on the books about how young women taken from their homes and their families are to be prepared for a night with the king. This is just ugly. In chapter 4, Esther needs to go to the king, but there's another law. Verse 11, "All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know. They know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live." In Persia, there is a law allowing the king to kill people who come into his presence without an invitation. These laws are crazy, right? Think about them. Like, what good is a law that tells you to drink as much as you want? Good laws are intended to restrain our desires, not encourage our indulgences, give us permission to indulge our unhealthy appetites. Good laws create safe guardrails. What do you even accomplish with this sort of law? And then what in the world does a law keeping one person away from the king accomplish? Not only that, but can we just call this what it is? It's petty. Laws are supposed to be for public good, but the king is busy passing laws that are deeply personal about personal offenses he's experienced. Again, the good of laws is that they can protect people and should protect people, but they are to serve the public. But the king puts into laws the practice of trafficking young women like property. And there seems to be a sort of expectation in their world that that was just normal. That's just what kings did. And then, to add injustice to injustice, he uses the law to mandate that the daughters he has stolen be perfectly prepared for him. On top of all of this, this king is supposed to be a public servant. The king should be available to his people, but this king is not. And the law allows him to simply kill people who bother him with their business. As you move through the book of Esther, these are the laws that appear throughout the story. But several times, we see the phrase, the king's word and law, or sometimes translated command and decree. The implication is that both the king's informal word and formal law have this governing authority. And so let me point out just a few of the king's informal commands. In chapter 1, verse 10, the king commands Queen Vashti to come to his presence. Chapter 3, verse 2, we learn that the king has commanded that everyone is to bow down and pay homage to Haman, his new second in command. Chapter 4, verse 2, we learn that there's a rule that prohibits anyone from entering the king's gate wearing sackcloth, which is what we see Mordecai wearing when he's lamenting. As you pay attention to the text, you just start to notice everywhere the king's word and decree, the king's command and law are everywhere. They permeate every part of your life. You can't escape them. And so you have to learn how to live with them. How do you survive in a world where your life is governed by so many laws? And what do you do when many of those laws are not just laws, right? They are unjust laws. What do you do when many of them are not wise laws? What do you do when many of them are not for your good or even the good of the public? How do we live in a world filled with these kinds of laws? Queen Vashti just said no. And so did Mordecai. Now, we don't know anything about Queen Vashti's refusal to come to the king. But many readers assume that at this point in her queenship, she was just done living according to the pleasures and desires and beck and call of the king. That this sort of command had happened just one too many times. And so she just gives up and says, no. She refuses to go along anymore. And there's something bold and noteworthy and beautiful and strong about this. And then there's Mordecai. He allows Esther to be taken into the king's harem, but we get the sense that he doesn't have a choice. And he doesn't come past the king's gate when he's wearing sackcloth. He follows the rules. He obeys the king's command and law. Except for when he doesn't. Like Vashti, Mordecai says no. He refuses to bow down to Haman, even though the king has commanded it. Both Vashti and Mordecai say no. And what happens to them? It's fascinating that both of them, Vashti and Mordecai, are punished, but not alone. Along with Vashti, all of the women in the empire are punished. And along with Mordecai, all of the Jews in the empire are punished. Vashti, she personally offends the king. And he uses the law to take it out on her and her entire group, pressing all women into a servant status in their homes. And then Mordecai personally offends Haman, and Haman uses the law to take it out on Mordecai and Mordecai's people, ordering the death and annihilation of every Jew. Are you tracking with this? For those who are drawn to acts of civil disobedience, it's worth noticing that in Esther, the story that Esther is telling is that those who willfully say no to the king's command and law, they end up suffering, but not just as individuals. See, powerful people are often also deeply insecure people, that they can't handle personal slights, personal offenses. And so they won't just take it out on you when you say no, but they will make your group pay. They will make an example out of you. And this is fascinating to notice, that the same thing happens to both Vashti and Mordecai. But they're not the only two people to break the law in this book. So does Esther. Esther comes into the king's presence when she has not been invited. This is an act, we're told, according to law, is punishable by death. And yet, she lives. And on top of that, her people live. Because through her act of disobedience, she is willing to risk her life by breaking this law. But as we'll consider, her act of breaking one law, of disobeying one law, was actually an act of obeying a higher law, the law of love for neighbor. But what gives? What is the difference? What's the difference between the no that Vashti and Mordecai give and Esther's response that results in law breaking? Well, track Esther's story with me here for a second. And we're gonna sort of look at an overview of who she is. We meet Esther as she is submitting to one of the most unjust laws I could ever imagine. I can't imagine living in a world where this was normal, okay, where you just accepted it. But she doesn't have much of an option. She dies, probably, if she resists. She's being trafficked as a piece of property. And yet, above it all, she goes. And she goes, and I can't understand it, but she does. And then in the next moment, we find Esther submitting to Mordecai. Mordecai has commanded her to not tell anyone about her Jewish identity. And so she goes years, she lives for years hiding the secret of who she is. And then we find her, we witness Esther submitting to the advice of one of the eunuchs who's in charge of the harem, the advice of Haggai. He tells her what to bring for her night with the king, and she submits to him, and she does it, she takes it. And then Esther submits to the king who took her from her family, when she tells him about the assassination plot against his life. And this is mind-blowing. Even though his death could mean her freedom, she submits to him. And then we see in the moment when Esther is confronted with the possibility of disobedience, of breaking the law, that she takes this very seriously. She is resistant to breaking the law, to going into the king's presence without his permission, his invitation, certainly because she's aware of the possibility of death. But then in that moment, Mordecai challenges her to see the bigger picture, to see her people, to see her role. And once again, she submits to Mordecai's advice. Which brings us to Esther's act of disobedience. It was not a straight and clear no. Also, it wasn't impulsive. It isn't rebellious. Esther prepares for this moment, and she actually invites her people to join with her to help her prepare for the moment. She passes this message along to Mordecai in chapter 4, verse 16. She says, "Go, gather all of the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will go to the king, though it is against the law. If I perish, I perish." Notice the difference between Esther's disobedience and Mordecai's. See, Mordecai makes this decision on his own, independent of anyone else, when he chooses to not bow down to Haman. And Mordecai's people suffer as a result of Mordecai's decision. Esther, considering breaking the law, she invites her people into the process with her. They collectively seek God's counsel and strength. Although God's not named, this is one of the underlying assumptions of what's happening here, that they are engaging in an ancient practice of lament and fasting that is their attempt to seek God. We don't know for sure what motivates Mordecai, but we do know that for Esther, it is her people. She is willing in this moment to risk her life for their sake. This is what the Bible calls love. This is how we begin to see that there is another law in play that she is finding herself aligned with. Esther goes on the most fascinating journey through this book from beginning to end. In many ways, you could sum it up by these two moments that bookend her story. Chapter 2, verse 20, Esther obeys Mordecai's command. Chapter 9, verse 32, Esther commands all of the Jews. She obeys Mordecai's command. She commands all of the Jews. I mean, these two moments, a moment of obedience and a moment of command, they surround the central moment when Esther knew, when she knew both when and how to disobey the law of the land. She knew when and how because she discerned with others when and how. She sought God's counsel and his strength to know when and how, and above all else, her disobedience was motivated by a superior law. She was motivated by love for her neighbor. These are the qualities that are learned through a life of submission, a life of submission that we see in Esther and every point leading up to this. I was reading some of Stanley Hauerwas's writings recently, some of it autobiographical, and he's a well-known theologian. You've heard me reference him before, but he is a Texan, and he grew up as a bricklayer, the son of a bricklayer. And he tells his story like this. He started laboring for his father, a bricklayer, when he was just 7 years old. But he knew how to lay brick by the time he was 10. And yet his father didn't let him lay brick until he was 16 years old. Almost 10 years of simply laboring. And as Hauerwas talks about this experience, the reason you labor for a bricklayer as long as you do is that you have to learn that laying brick isn't about laying brick quickly, but about laying brick well. As a young 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 10-year-old, as a young teenager, we tend to be zealous and excited, and we tend to think that we know how to do it better than our elders and the adults. We think we can do things faster. But years of laboring teach you that laying brick isn't about laying brick quickly, but about laying brick well. Hauerwas says that you only learn the importance of laying brick well by spending years submitting to a master bricklayer who sometimes gives you embarrassing rules, embarrassing instructions, hard rules, hard instructions. But over time, you watch as you help and you labor for this bricklayer. You watch what it looks like for good brick to be laid. And at the same time, your submission, it slows you down a bit. It slows your zealousness down a bit. It slows your sense of being able to do this quickly and faster down a bit. It makes you wait. It shows you the virtue of patience. See, he spent years as a laborer chopping mud, pitching brick, building scaffold and joint because he knew that he could lay brick faster than his dad. And he would tell his dad and annoy his dad that they could save time, they could get more work done, they could finish more jobs, they could make more money. But laying brick quickly is not the goal. Laying brick well is the goal. And by laboring, submitted to the master bricklayer, you learn the virtue of patience. You learn through submission how to be a patient bricklayer. This is so good, so challenging for me. It reminds me that this is the way that it works with laws or rules or commands. This is the way it works for Esther. See, the book of Esther seems to suggest something that I think we hear frequently in different places from Jesus, which is you can only be trusted with much. Esther is trusted with commanding all of the Jews because she is faithful with little. In the small moments, she submits, she obeys. And so she can be trusted with much. You can only be trusted to command others if you are capable of submitting to others. You can only be trusted to make good laws, to give good commands, if you are able to submit to bad laws and bad commands. And now I'm not talking about egregious injustices, right? We see Esther in the moment of grievous injustice beginning to engage in a new way. But you can only be trusted to make good laws and give good commands if you can submit to bad laws and bad commands. And this was one of the things that I began to learn to be challenged by early on in my faith journey. You've heard me many times tell the story of how black my heart was. In high school, I would not be told what to do by anybody. And here I am giving Jesus my life, and almost immediately I'm being invited onto something called Work Crew, a month where I go to a camp and I'm just told what to do the entire time. And my job is not the job that I want. I want to be the server. I want to be interacting with people. I want to be out front and up front and establishing relationships. And they tell me, you will go into the pits and you will wash dishes for a month. This broke me in one of the best ways you can imagine. I began to learn what it meant to submit my life to others. This was the beginning in many ways of a life of service. One of the things we discover in the book of Esther is that if you say no to every law that you don't like, if you say no to every command that is bad, if you say no to every decree that is inconvenient, when it comes time to really stand against the truly egregious law, the completely unjust command, you may have lost whatever voice you could have had. I think because of Esther's obedience and her submission, and each of the moments leading up to the decisive point, She has earned a right to be heard to some degree. She's established a relationship where she has some capital to draw on. Now, I don't think Esther tells us exactly how this all works. I don't think Esther gives us the answer about how exactly we are supposed to navigate the world of bad laws and commands, but Esther does challenge us to be slow to just say no outright, so that we can instead be wise and discerning with our disobedience. Remember, Esther knew when and how to disobey because submission was her default posture in life, because she sought the wisdom of others, because she sought God's counsel and strength with her community, and because her disobedience was motivated by a higher law. It was motivated by love for her neighbor. I want to take the last few minutes to transition away from Esther and away from us and fix our eyes on God, which is hard to do in the book of Esther, where God is never mentioned, to say, where is God at work? But I want to point out an observation that's made by a number of scholars. It's often believed that King Xerxes is deliberately portrayed in Esther as the sort of opposite of God, the anti-God. That everything that he does, that Xerxes does, is kind of the opposite of God, which is supposed to stir in God's people this reminder of how good and trustworthy and faithful their God is. And so here are a couple of the ways that we see this. God's words, God's commands, we read this throughout scripture, are always good. God's words, his commands, they bless creation, they bring life, they protect, they guard, they guide. Sabbath isn't a great example of this. The gift of rest every 7 days is a guardrail for life. It's one of God's good and life-giving gifts. Xerxes, on the other hand, his words, commands, just are bad. They don't give life, they take life constantly. God, his words, God's commands, they aren't reactive and they aren't petty, but they are wise and they are deliberate. A great example of this would be the Jubilee found in Leviticus 25. I mean, this amazingly brilliant command, it is for the undoing of all economic injustice in a community. It is about bringing complete restoration to a community. Its wisdom is seen in its foresight. It is a law given 50 years in advance. It anticipates the sinfulness of people, the greed of people, the injustice of people. And it says in 50 years, you're going to need this complete reset, right? I mean, talk about foresight and planning and wisdom and patience. Consider Xerxes, where his laws come from. Their knee-jerk reactions, written in a moment, changed in a second moment. On top of all of this, we think about God, who can be trusted to keep his promises. We think about a God who makes steady commandments, a God who speaks reliable words. Think about the Ten Commandments. These commandments, they remain as true to God's purposes today as they were 3,000 years ago. They're given at Sinai by Moses, and Jesus affirms them, and Paul affirms them over this long period of time. Contrast that with Xerxes. Xerxes makes a law to murder the Jews in one moment, and in the next moment he makes a law to allow the Jews to defend themselves against their attackers. Xerxes can never keep his mind straight. He can't keep his laws straight. Xerxes can never be trusted to stay true to the course. This is an important lesson for us. Human rulers cannot be trusted to maintain the course, which means in any moment where you are excited about a law that passes, it's good, it seems just. Don't forget, we live in a world of human rulers, and it doesn't take much to counter it, to undo it. This is the way that our world works. Xerxes cannot be trusted. There's always a bit of anxiety under Xerxes' reign because we know that what is good today may not last till tomorrow. And on top of this, Xerxes' laws are almost always about himself. And this is, in many ways, is the biggest contrast with God because God's laws are entirely focused on others. I shared part of this passage in our midweek connection on Wednesday night on Zoom. But in his letter to the church in Rome, Paul summarizes all of God's laws in this way. He says, For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. The commandments, and he goes on to list them all, are summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. The laws in our world are always going to fall short of God's good standard. But even God's good laws require interpretation on our part. They require us to understand how they are calling us to love. Love. God is love. We know what love is in that Christ laid down his life for us. Love is the highest law. Love is the character of God. Love is the will of God. Love is the law of Christ. Which means for us, it is an act of love for our neighbors when we submit to the laws of our society. And sometimes it is an act of love for our neighbors to disobey the law. So which is it? Well, if we learn anything from Esther, we will only ever know which is right if submission and obedience is the habit of our lives, if we will discern with others which is right, if we will seek God's counsel and strength together, and if we keep love at the very forefront of our lives, which means we keep the God who is love, Christ, who shows us what love is, at the very center of our lives. This is how we make our way through a world filled with flaws. We love the one who is love. And we submit ourselves to the one who gives us the best law, the law of love. Amen. Thanks, my brothers and sisters.